the last thing I remember is this Chinook coming into land, this huge sandstorm that it creates from the propeller blades, the exhaust, the heat from the exhaust beating down on me in the back of this vehicle, and then like the mechanical noise of the tailgate dropping, and then I blacked out at that point. I later found out that they had classed me as dead. You know, that was it. When I got on the back of the helicopter, they checked me for signs of life. They said I didn't have any of what they were looking for, and they put me in a corner because there was one other casualty, and they had to get to work on him to make sure that he didn't die as well. You know, they checked me for a pulse. They checked me to try and put fluids in me. They couldn't. They put an oxygen mask on me, which should have steamed up, but it didn't. So that's why they said, okay, this guy's dead, leave him. Now, when one of the medics walked past me to get some equipment to work on the other guy, he said that my eyes started to flutter, which meant my heart was still beating. So he alerted some of the other medics. They came back. And 3 days before this incident, whoever is in charge of the army medical field had given the green light for this new technique to be used, where if you can't get intravenous lines into somebody's veins, you drill into their tibia and fibula and you put the line in there. So that's what they wanted to do to me. Problem being, my tibias and fibulas had been ripped off by this IED, so they had nothing to work with. My name is Mark Ormerod. I'm a former Royal Marines Commando, and I was injured in Afghanistan back on Christmas Eve 2007 and became the UK's first triple amputee from the conflict. It's brutal. It's world renowned for being arguably the longest and hardest regular forces training in the world. Special forces training is obviously that next level, but in terms of regular forces infantry, it's the longest and hardest in the world. And you have to be extremely fit physically, and it's very progressive and gradual, and you build up over 32 plus weeks to be able to do the final phase, which is called the commando phase. But if you're not mentally robust, if you can't be cold, wet, sleep deprived, food deprived, you know, covered in blisters with 4 or 5 miles left to march, if you can't do that and conquer your mind, then you won't make it. And then I've seen people that are 100 times fitter than me physically fail because they don't like the other side of it. Brain starts telling you you're in pain, and you know, just stop, just quit, and you know, maybe you're running, you throw up, and whatever it is. When that voice starts creeping in, you're probably only about 40% physically to actually shutting down. And once you understand that and you know it's part of the process and part of the game, and you say, okay, I'm at that point now, I want to quit, just push a little bit more and then I'm through it. That's the biggest thing I've ever learned. Like, whenever that voice creeps in, you're not even halfway to your body failing. Most of my friends had left school, left education, and gone on to start their careers. And a huge chunk of them had joined the military. And they were in the army. I had friends in Germany, friends in the UK, friends that were dotted all over the world. And they would always come home on their leave periods. And it seemed like they always had, you know, cool stories to tell me. They had money in the bank. They were always out partying. My exams were on the horizon. What do I want to do? Do I want to go on to further education, or do I want to go and start a career? So one of my friends who was already serving took me down to the career center one day, and I spoke to the recruiter. He gave me all the paperwork that I needed. Because of my age, I had to take it back and get my parents to sign it. I had a training program that was written specifically for me by the Royal Marines, and that's all I did. I wasn't interested in anything else, you know, going out partying, messing around. It was just training, following that program to the letter, waiting for a letter to drop on my doorstep saying, come and start your training. My dad told me that I had an uncle who was actually a retired Royal Marine, and he only lived about 15 miles up the road. So we hopped in the car, we drove up there one weekend, and he talked me through his entire career. He started as a Marine, which is our equivalent of a private, And 22 years later, he retired as a captain. And he told me why the Royal Marines were different, the kind of things that he'd done in his career, what I could expect to experience if that's the route that I wanted to go down. So I then went back home, back to the career center. I spoke to the Royal Marines recruiter, and he pulled out, this is how long ago it was, he pulled out the VHS cassette. He put it in one of those TV video combi things that were all the rage back in the day. And I watched this video and my jaw like hit the floor. I saw guys, you know, fast roping out of helicopters, skiing in the Arctic, up to their chest in water going through the jungle. You know, and it just seemed like these guys could go anywhere, do anything at any time. And I got goosebumps. I'm getting goosebumps now just thinking about it. And that was it. I wanted to be a Royal Marines commando, and that was all I was focused on. And when I left school, that's exactly what I did. You know, I was 17 years old when I did it. I was still a boy, and I was surrounded by men. I was the second youngest in my troop. Everyone else had more life experience and more experience in everything than I did. And it was very overwhelming. It was very scary. It was very intimidating. And you have to adapt really quickly and just run with it. And I think you develop your own way of dealing with it. And what I did personally was, you know, 30 weeks is a long time. It's 32 now, it's 30 when I did it. You have to break that down to chunks, you know, almost month by month, week by week, and then sometimes day by day. And that was the mindset that I adopted. I just thought, right, get through this day, get through this week, get through this month, tick the box, and then we restart again and, you know, keep pushing, keep pushing, keep pushing. And eventually, you know, as long and as arduous as it was, eventually you'll get there and then you can start your career and do the fun stuff. So I started training in February 2001 when I was 17, and I finished in October 2001. 9/11 was September 2001. So 4 weeks before I finished my training, we all witnessed that. And so we knew that everything we've been trained to do, we were going to have to put into practice in the real world very, very quickly. You know, for an 18-year-old who was about to earn his Green Beret and become a Royal Marines Commando, who's very cocky and arrogant and brash at that age, you think you're invincible. 2003, Iraq came around and I was deployed on Operation Telic 1. So we spent about a month in Kuwait. We sat on that border, and then when we were given the green light, we pushed over that Kuwaiti Iraqi border and we went and did what we had to do in Iraq. And I spent 3.5 months in there. And I didn't fire a single round. You know, I came back, I was assigned with a couple of my friends as force protection for a medical regiment. So I thought we'd see a lot of action. I didn't see a thing. And I came back, and as weird as it sounds, I was disappointed. I thought, I've done all this training, and you know, I'm supposed to be this elite level soldier, and I'm supposed to be able to go and do the business. I've just gone to war. I was 19 by this point. I've earned a Green Beret. I've been to war. I've kind of ticked a few boxes already. Anything else now is just a bonus. When Afghanistan became a hot topic again, I would get the opportunity to go out to a different kind of environment and then actually test my skills and see if I was good enough. They were worlds apart. In Afghanistan, as soon as you hit the ground, you hit the ground running. And you could be fighting at all different hours of the day, 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, it doesn't matter. You know, night, day, all throughout the year. It's very comfortable in that environment. And I think that was mostly down to knowing about the men I had around me, who had all been through the same training, who were all at the same level, who were all extremely professional, and we all had each other's back. So despite how dangerous the environment was, I knew all around me were men that were willing to do whatever it takes to keep me safe, as I would be willing to do whatever it takes to keep them safe. Up to the headquarters compound. It was Christmas Eve 2007. We were called up to the headquarters compound and we were given a brief on a foot patrol that we were going to go on, something we'd done a million times before in the 3 months that we'd been there. We went back to our compound as normal, started preparing all of our kit and equipment as normal, and then we went back up to the headquarters compound. We formed up by the rear entrance of our camp in two sections, and we got ready to leave. Now, the idea of this patrol was that we would have two sections with eight men in each section. We'd leave the rear entrance of camp. One section would go north, one would go south. We got told to patrol the immediate perimeter of the camp, pushing no more than 300 meters out. And then the two sections would meet at the front entrance of the camp, so now the opposite side, secure the location, close things down, and finish up for the day. Now, in terms of what we had done to that point, this was the most basic kind of patrol that you could ever go on. Prior to that, we had been going, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 miles out, 8, 9, 10 hours, whatever it was. We had a mission, we had an objective. We'd go out, we'd execute that, and we'd come back. This was literally go out the back door, walk around camp, come in the front door. Now, we had no intelligence that gave us any cause for concern. We had a very firm grasp on our area of operations. We knew what was going on. So it was a walk in the park, or so we thought. The time came. They opened up the rear entrance. I was second in command of the section that went north. The other guys went south. And we went out and did what we were tasked to do. About 5 hours into it, both sections then found themselves at the opposite side of camp. So now at the front entrance, ready to close things down, to finish it up and go back into camp. Now my section, we're on a high piece of ground, what we call the North Fort. Just underneath us, when we looked down, we could see the base that we're working out of. And then beneath that, just off to the side of the main dirt road that ran through the area, was the other section that we left for earlier in the day. Now, because we're in an elevated position, tactically, we're in a very advantageous position because we can see everything around us and it's a lot easier to fight going down a hill than it is up. So our job to finish up was to give those guys protection so they could go back in the camp, get behind the perimeter wall. They were safe. They would then protect us. We'd go back in, finish up. Done for the day. Very, very easy, basic, low-level stuff. So we're up on the high feature, and the section commander took his half of the section and started giving them fire positions. I took my half of the section, and about 4 meters in front of me, there was a shallow bowl in the ground. Now, normally what you would do, if you go firm on a patrol, if you stop, you would take cover behind a building, a wall, a tree, a rock, whatever you can find to give yourself protection and cover. But we're on a high feature. And I saw this bowl and thought, okay, if we get in there, we get down on our stomachs, you're not going to be able to see us. It's going to be very difficult to attack us. This is the best form of protection that we can have given the environment that we're in. So I jumped in. The other half of the section started taking up their fire positions. When they were happy, they gave me the thumbs up. I had a couple of last minute checks I had to run through. And then when I was happy, I slowly started walking over towards the position that I selected for myself. And as I went to get down to my stomach, I put my right knee on the floor. And that was the moment that I knelt on and detonated an improvised explosive device. So you have to imagine the terrain that we're working in, right? It's very, very sandy, very, very dusty. So when this IED detonated, this huge dust cloud was created and I couldn't see anything and I was in no pain and I could hear all the guys around me shouting and screaming, trying to figure out what had gone on. And my gut instinct was that we had been attacked. I thought someone had fired a rocket or a mortar on our position. It had exploded nearby, which is why this dust cloud was created. You know, everyone's shouting and screaming and I can't see anything. And I just wait for this dust cloud to settle. And I think if I can see what's going on, I can assess the situation better, make some calls and figure something out. And the cloud gets to about chest height. And you got to imagine, I'm pumped full of adrenaline. My fight and flight is kicked in. I'm ready to go. And I'm looking around and I'm panicking, just hoping that everyone's okay and I can't see anybody. So I carry on waiting for this dust cloud to settle and it hits the ground. It disappears and I look down to where my legs should have been and they had both been completely ripped off from the knees down. I think your brain finds it very hard to process what it is it's looking at. And then when you add to that the fact that you're not in any pain, just very uncomfortable. It's like an intense pins and needles feeling. You're trying to look at this and process it, and it doesn't feel real. And there's no pain, which makes it feel even less real. And it's just, everything inside is going at 1,000 miles an hour, but everything outside is in slow motion while you're trying to figure this out. And you know, the way your body reacts is crazy, the way it just goes into like self-preservation mode. But despite, you know, the severity of my injuries, both legs, my right arm was torn off, it was still attached, but everything was just shredded inside. Despite the severity of my injuries, this crater that I was in, I read the report, it was now 12 feet deep by 15 feet around. There were 6 other devices around me. Despite all of that, like I said earlier, those men that I was working with were so professional and good at what they did. I never really thought that I wouldn't make it out of there. And they just clicked straight into action. But no one panicked, nobody froze, nobody went outside of protocol. We'd rehearsed this kind of stuff. They all just kicked straight in, did what they needed to do. And the medic got to me very, very quickly. You know, he did what he needed to do. He put the morphine in, put the tourniquets on, put me on a stretcher. My right leg was still attached, and we had to pick it up and put it on my stomach because it was hanging off the end of the stretcher. I don't know how they got me off this high feature because I had my eyes closed, but they got me out of this crater, off this high feature, to where our vehicle was waiting. And they put me in the back of the vehicle, and these are not tarmac roads, they're very, very bumpy. So the guy driving floors the accelerator and gets thrown all over the back of his vehicle. He starts climbing up this hill to go into the front entrance of the camp, and he's got to go left and right because of the terrain. And the medic fell out the back. I fell out the back. The guy driving swung around, reached out to grab me to hold me in. He grabbed the femur bone that was coming out of my right leg, kind of held me. My tailbone is on the back end of the vehicle, the tailgate. He held me half in, half out. The medic was fine because that other section we were with earlier with those 8 heavily armed men, they were at the bottom of the hill, so the medic was safe. He carried on driving, got me back into the camp, got me to the helicopter landing site. And the last thing I remember is this Chinook coming into land, this huge sandstorm that it creates from the propeller blades, the exhaust, the heat from the exhaust beating down on me in the back of this vehicle, and then like the mechanical noise of the tailgate dropping, and then I blacked out at that point. I later found out that they had classed me as dead. You know, that was it. When I got on the back of the helicopter, they checked me for signs of life. They said I didn't have any of what they were looking for, and they put me in a corner because there was one other casualty, and they had to get to work on him to make sure that he didn't die as well. You know, they checked me for a pulse. They checked me to try and put fluids in me. They couldn't. They put an oxygen mask on me, which should have steamed up, but it didn't. So that's why they said, okay, this guy's dead, leave him. Now, when one of the medics walked past me to get some equipment to work on the other guy, he said that my eyes started to flutter, which meant my heart was still beating. So he alerted some of the other medics. They came back. And 3 days before this incident, whoever is in charge of the army medical field had given the green light for this new technique to be used, where if you can't get intravenous lines into somebody's veins, you drill into their tibia and fibula and you put the line in there. So that's what they wanted to do to me. Problem being, my tibias and fibulas had been ripped off by this IED, so they had nothing to work with. Now, in this particular situation, it was an anti-personnel mine, which is only designed to blow off a foot. The idea behind them is it will maim somebody, and then when everyone else goes in to help them, you know, the enemy will usually pop over the hill with AK-47s and wipe everyone out. So it was an anti-personnel mine. But on top of it, they had put the warhead of a 107mm Chinese rocket, which is like a shoulder launch rocket, which will take the side of the house off. So I stood on the warhead. The warhead put pressure on the mine, the plates in the mine touched, the mine erupted, the warhead erupted, and then I erupted. And the only thing I can think of as to why I'm still alive is the angle that it got me at. If it went straight up, it literally would have incinerated me. There would have been nothing left of my body. Put my right arm down to get onto my belly, and it just took off both the legs and the arm. So they drilled into my hip from the front and back. They put a line in. They said the first time that the skin was too loose, so it didn't bite. So they pulled it, they tightened it, and they put it in again. And they said the second time it bit, the fluids went in. And within like 3 minutes, they said I was back. So they flew me back to Camp Bastion, to the temporary field hospital that was there. And the surgeons that were working that day had a look at the damage caused by the IED, and it was a mess. And they decided that the only way they were going to be able to save my life is if they took off both my legs above the knee and my right arm above the elbow. So, I passed out when the Chinook landed, and I woke up 4 days later, on the 28th of December, in Selly Oak Hospital in Birmingham, in intensive care. I woke up for about 15 seconds and then just passed back out because I was exhausted. So what they did in intensive care, they kind of reduced the medication to bring you out of the coma. And I woke up for that first 15 seconds and I couldn't even open my eyes. I was so exhausted. And then I blacked out. But they kind of knew then that I was, not that I was okay, but that I was making progress. So then they started reducing the medication. They brought me out of the coma. And then I spent 7 days in intensive care, each day spending more and more time awake in the real world, reducing the medication so that I could gradually understand where I was, what had happened, and the severity of my injuries. And, you know, they did it perfectly. You know, it wasn't like I woke up cold turkey and was like, where am I, what's happened, and started freaking out. It was like a gradual drip feed, day by day, over the course of a week, where initially I thought I'd lost my feet and some fingers, and by the end of 7 days I realised it was both legs above the knee and my right arm above the elbow. Initially I wasn't in a good place. You know, I was 24 years old. I was at that time 6'2", 16 stone, physically I think at my peak. And then I woke up in hospital and I'm like 4'3". Because of losing three limbs and the infections I was fighting off, I was probably 8'11", I think, and full of tubes and everything. And I also had a huge hole in my hand from a shrapnel wound. I could only use two fingers and was just lying in bed thinking. That's all I could do. And initially I was not in a good place. I think in the beginning there was a lot of kind of falseness between me and the people around me. It was almost like false positivity. You know, if I was feeling bad, I would act like I wasn't. And if they were struggling, they would act like they weren't. And it, even though it was a little bit false, it helped. And it, you know, just trying to force a bit more of a positive atmosphere kind of really helped. And then 3.5 weeks into it, a doctor walked in. He wasn't part of my team, I'd not met him before. And he told me he was the UK's leading professional in the field of amputations. Like, for 33 years at that point, he had been amputating people's limbs, following up their progress, and he was like the UK's guru. And he came in and said, I have never met anybody in my 33 plus years who's got one leg missing above the knee that has any success using prosthetics. So you need to start mentally preparing yourself for life in a wheelchair. And you've got to imagine, I've come from like alpha male peak to now at 24 years old. In my mind, thinking I need carers, people to wash me, people to feed me, you know, push me around in a wheelchair. And, you know, that's really not what I wanted to hear at that stage. I'm 3.5 weeks into my recovery. So that sent me into a spiral. And, you know, I don't mind admitting this, I contemplated suicide at that point. I was dealing with a lot, and it got to the point where you kind of feel like you've you've snapped, and then the only really thing you think is, I don't want to do this. You know, and it is, and I mean this with utmost respect, it's a little bit of a pity party where you're just feeling sorry for yourself because you don't know what the answer is. I never would have done it. I was never in that place mentally where, you know, I was numb or never saw a future. You know, I was just feeling sorry for myself. But about a week later, I got an unexpected visit in my hospital room, and a guy knocked on the door and he came in, and he was wearing two prosthetic legs. And he was a double above knee amputee like I was. He had both his arms, but our legs were very similar. And he sat me down and he talked me through his journey. He had been hit by a suicide bomber in Iraq in 2005. He talked me through the journey of getting from the hospital to getting prosthetics, to regaining your independence, and what it was going to take, and, you know, some of his highs and lows. And after about 6 hours, he left. And that was it. My mindset was changed because I had physically seen somebody who had achieved what I wanted to achieve. And then it didn't matter what you told me about how you couldn't do this and couldn't do that. I witnessed it with my own eyes, someone else doing it, which meant to me there was no reason at all why I couldn't do it. And I knew I was missing the right arm. That was my dominant arm, but it didn't matter. You know, I saw this guy had done it. I listened to what he told me. And from that point on, I was like, there's no way you can stop me. Give me the legs. Give me the rehab. Let's go. During those really low, really dark moments, the support system around you is crucial. And when you move forward from that and they help pull you out of that, you realize that in life in general, it's very advantageous to have good people around you. You know, keep that circle tight of good people that support you, empower you, motivate you, inspire you. I had incredible support around me, you know, from my family, from the Royal Marines, all the doctors, nurses, surgeons, everyone around me just kind of came together to get me through those initial couple of weeks of dark thoughts and hardship. And it worked out, you know, it worked out in the end. Very early on, and this is what I attribute a lot of success to, is having goals and something to focus on and drive towards. And my goal was, when my unit came back, because they were still in Afghanistan when I was in hospital, my goal was when they came back and we had our big medals parade at the unit with all our friends and family in attendance, that I would wear prosthetic legs. You know, it wasn't going to be pretty, but I was going to walk onto the parade ground and stand and get that medal. I didn't want to be in a wheelchair with people pitying me and feeling sorry for me. And then I got out of hospital after 6 weeks. Got straight to rehab. I couldn't jump straight into prosthetics because of the scars and the wounds that I had, but I worked on everything else. I started working my core and all the other muscles I needed to work to be able to walk, my glutes, hips, lower back, strengthening those day by day, getting stronger, making sure I was eating the right kind of foods. You know, rest wasn't a problem because I couldn't do much else but rest and do a little bit of physical activity. But having that goal was massive because, you know, you get up in the morning and your back hurts and you've got blisters in your groin and you just, you know, you're exhausted and you don't want to do anything. But having that goal and the thought of failing that just drives you, you know. And I didn't want to, in my mind, I didn't want to let anybody down. I wanted to go up there, stand shoulder to shoulder with those guys that I fought with, make them proud, make the wider Royal Marines proud, make friends and family proud. And so that was it. Like, when I felt sorry for myself, I just always went back to that goal and thought, this is what I'm doing it for. Every day was an obstacle. For a double above knee amputee, it takes anywhere between 300 and 500% more energy for me to do anything than it does for an able-bodied person. And so I thought, you know, being a Royal Marine, I'm pretty fit, it's not going to be an issue. It was an issue. You know, I the first day I walked one length of the parallel bars, which is about 6 meters, it wiped me out. I was exhausted and I had to go back to my room and sleep
can have an afternoon nap, because it just wiped me completely out. And you know, every day you're getting a little bit stronger, a little bit fitter, you're getting a little bit more used to the legs, but it's just unbelievably difficult in the beginning, you know. And then when you add to that that I only had one arm and it was my weak arm, and I'm trying to do everything and relearn, and you know, everything was an obstacle in those early days. Absolutely everything.
Such a vivid picture in my mind of what that would look like, with, you know, desert uniform on, green beret on, everyone formed up on the parade ground, thousands of people's friends and family around, and me just standing at the sidelines. And like I said, it wouldn't be pretty, but I would do what I could to get onto that parade ground and stand next to them for when that medal got presented to me. And that was, it was such a vivid image that it just motivated the heck out of me just to go off and do whatever it took, no matter how sore I was, tired I was, how many times I hit the deck and, you know, cut myself, bruised myself. I would just go back at the end of the day, remember why I was doing it, remember what the goal was, and then just shake it off and start again the next day. And I hope I didn't show it too much, but even that was horrendous. I was in unbelievable amounts of pain because I still hadn't healed properly. Even for me to stand on the spot, it's like you marching, you know, like jogging on the spot with your knees up high. And I was there for 45 minutes and I was just terrified. I was terrified that I was going to fall over and embarrass myself and hurt myself. But I just, you know, I had a constant conversation in my head about why I was there, why I was doing it, and what it was going to be like if I was successful. I realized that I'd done it before. So when I competed in martial arts, I always used to visualize myself getting my hand raised. When I was going through Royal Marines training, I always visualized what it would feel like to be presented with that green beret. And then when I, you know, achieved that goal at the Meadows Parade, I came home here on a Friday evening and I just thought, this is what I need to do in my life, for everything. Not just, you know, set one goal to walk at the Meadows Parade, fitness, finance, family, every area that's important in my life, I need to set goals in these areas and drive forward towards achieving them. Because I think it's very dangerous, not just in my situation, but in anyone's situation, if you stay static for too long and the negative thoughts start coming in. You've always got to have something positive to move towards and strive towards, to occupy your headspace. You know, 80, 90, 95% of it has got to be positive and driving forward towards something that you want to achieve. You know, you can find inspiration everywhere. And I was always researching people. There was a guy in America. I actually flew out to America in 2009 to be mentored by another triple amputee, because I was the UK's first. And I knew if I needed to level up, I needed to learn from this guy. And he was running, swimming, surfing, driving. He was a motivational speaker. And I was being told, you know, you can't do this, you can't do that, that's not possible, no one's ever done that before. And I'm watching this guy, Cameron, on the internet, doing all these things that people would tell me a triple amputee shouldn't be able to do. And his injuries were exactly the same as mine. In fact, his arm was even higher than mine. And I'm just watching this guy doing it all. And I constantly consumed his content as motivation, you know, because I saw it was physically possible. And I knew that if he could do it, I could do it. And I eventually ended up on the 9th of June 2009, I flew out to meet him. I went through a 3-week boot camp with him and his team. They made me leave my wheelchair in the UK. They made me fly it on my own. Couldn't take anyone with me, which I don't mind admitting was terrifying at the time. But they hammered me for 3 weeks solid, and I never used my wheelchair since. 9th of June 2009, you can search my house. There's not a wheelchair here or anywhere near here. I got rid of it, gave it to the hospital, and just became a full-time prosthetic user. Mindset changed, and I was introduced to a whole new world of, you know, being an amputee, using prosthetics. A couple of reasons why I live my life the way I do. The first one is to let the guys on the ground that saved me know, the medics on the helicopter that saved me know, the doctors, nurses, everyone that's been involved in my journey, to let them know that everything they did was perfect and correct. And you know, I'm out living my life the fullest I can because of what they did for me, but also because I want to show other people. You know, it's a pretty severe situation to be in when you lose three limbs. And if I can live my life the way I want to live it and enjoy it and embrace everything that this brings with it, I'm hoping that can inspire other people to do the same thing. And there's inspiration everywhere. I don't know, you know, if you wanted to be, I don't know, like a property millionaire, right? Just go and find someone who's already been a property millionaire. Find out what they did physically, mentally, you know, and kind of replicate it as closely as you can. That's what I did with Cameron in America. I found a guy who'd achieved what I wanted to achieve, and I went out and met him, and I mirrored what he did as closely as I possibly could to achieve the results that he had as closely as I possibly could. You know, it's not that complicated, you know, but you've got to want it enough. It's got to be, you've got to be passionate about it, and it's got to be something that gives you goosebumps when you think about it. When I achieved my Green Beret, you know, I was only 18 years old at the time, so I was still a boy. And when I got that and it was presented to me, it massively opened my eyes to what you can achieve if you're mentally prepared in the right way and you have the right mindset. Because I was not, and I am not, the fittest or strongest person in the world. I'm just ridiculously stubborn, and I'll just keep driving forward no matter what. And then when I went through rehab, it was exactly the same. It was, you know, this is the goal. Just keep moving forward. And even if you're just making 1% every day, you're still moving forward. Just keep that mindset of move forward. And then eventually, you're going to achieve what you set out to achieve. Should spend a bit of time living outside that comfort zone, doing something that pushes you and challenges you and forces you to grow physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, whatever it is. Because my belief is that human beings are the happiest when they're making progress and they're moving forward with something, you know, and that's going to look different for different people. But I mean, you just think about it, people go on weight loss journeys or fitness journeys, you know, and they're seeing progress. That's when they're full of life and energy. When they've pushed outside their comfort zone, they've set a goal and they're taking steps towards achieving that goal. You know, you can do that in so many different areas of your life. It could be with your children, with your finances, with your career, you know, but it's not always easy to do because it feels uncomfortable, you know, but that's where the growth is and that's where the magic happens. You've got to push outside the comfort zone. Like right here, right now, with the way, you know, the way my children have grown up, the way my family are, the way my career is, the way my health is, everything that has gone on before has led to this moment right now. And everything feels great, you know, despite my situation and circumstances, and people find this difficult, they think it's all, you know, sometimes when I say this stuff, it's false. But everything's led to this point now where my life is great, you know, and that's probably what I'm proudest of, the effort and the work that I've put into to create this life. But I've died once and I realized how quick that can happen and how fast things can change. And what I do not want to do is get to, you know, 105 years old, because my big goal is to live past 100, and think that I didn't squeeze all the juice out of my life. You know, and there's no real reason why anyone can't do any of the things that they want to do. We live in, you know, it's 2021. You can run a business on a smartphone. I've got £100,000 of a prosthetic legs that I can do anything with. I can travel the world independently as a guy missing three limbs. I can do whatever I want. You know, you can so much with the technology that we have nowadays, that the whole world's open to just go out and do whatever you love, whatever you're passionate about, and live the way you want to live. You just got to ditch the excuses and kind of move out your comfort zone a little bit. My ultimate goal is to become the ultimate version of myself. And what's beautiful about that is you can't ever achieve it, and it keeps you constantly striving forward. So I'm going through a phase right now where I'm 38, right? And I'm starting to tailor off a little bit physically. I can't move as fast or as strong as I used to, but I'm adapting and rolling with it because I still want to keep pushing and going and becoming, you know, better as I age. I just want to deep inside know that I've always pushed myself to be the best version that I can be as husband, father, employee, member of society, athlete, whatever it is. I'm just always trying to keep pushing the envelope a little bit. It's in those moments you need to search for what you're grateful for. So I lost both my legs and my right arm, but I was grateful that I still had a fully functioning left arm. My face is untouched. I have no internal injuries. I have no traumatic brain injuries. I don't have post-traumatic stress disorder. You know, those are all things for me to be grateful of. I have this technology. You know, back then my mindset was, I have this technology that's going to enable me to live an independent life. They're all things to be grateful for. The support system around me, you know, all that kind of stuff. You have to work at it, but you can find something to be grateful for in any situation. You know, as bad as it gets, if nothing else, just know it's going to make you stronger when you come out the other side of it, and that's something to be grateful for. Don't limit what you can achieve. You know, 30, 40 years ago, someone in my situation probably would have been very limited. You know, I've been in a wheelchair, probably with carers, people looking after me, and my life would have been very different to the way it is now. But you want to talk about gratitude again? Look at the day and age we live in. I run 2 businesses from a mobile phone. You know, I get to go out and share my story with the world and earn a living from it. You know, I'm grateful for all that stuff. Nothing's limited. There's opportunity in adversity. Nowadays, more than ever, you can take a bad situation like this and flip it on its head and turn it into something brilliant. Not only to create the life you want to live, but to help motivate and inspire other people. You can influence as many millions of people as you want on Instagram or TikTok or YouTube, but you know, it's your family, your children, your close circle that I think means the most. It's being all you can be, you know what I mean? It's unleashing your full potential. I mean, everyone has a passion, you know what I mean? Like you say, it's just maybe finding it, and people maybe know what it is but don't recognize it as a passion. Some people can be passionate about watching movies. That's the thing that they love to do more than anything else in the world. Do more of that. Some people love, I don't understand why they do this, but like ultramarathon runners, it's crazy, it's sick, but they love that, it's passionate. Go do more of that. You know, it's, you have to do the things that you love in life. You know, when I was in the Marines, I loved that. I loved the people around me. I loved the way it made me grow, the experiences I got to have. Now, as a triple amputee, I'm passionate about living my life the best that I can and going out and doing all the things that I want to do. You know what I mean? So you have to do it. You have to do it. Don't make excuses why you can't do it. And work too hard, get up an hour earlier. I've got kids, so have I. You know, you work it around, double tap it, bring your kids in, involve them in the passion. You know, I love doing jiu-jitsu. I take my boy to jiu-jitsu with me. I'm spending time with him and I'm doing what I love. Hopefully then he'll develop some sort of passion out of that. And he'll discover what he loves, and you just spread it around. But you can't get trapped into that cycle of, you know, just going around the hamster wheel. You know, you've got to take that time to figure out what you love doing. If I'm competing for something, then I do become obsessed, but I would call it a healthy obsession. So 2017, 2018, I competed in the Invictus Games, representing the UK with different countries from all over the world, and that was a bit of an obsession for 2 years. I'd be here in this garage at 5 o'clock 4 or 5 days a week doing cardio. I would have a full-time day job, and then I would do strength and conditioning in the evening and spend my weekends doing sports specific training. And that was 2 years of obsession. It never got unhealthy. I'd always keep it healthy and keep that in mind, keep that balance. People can tip too far and be obsessed, and that comes at a cost. You've got to keep that obsession healthy. Physical pain, mental pain, it's all stuff that you can overcome. You know, I used to, in the beginning, have something called phantom limb pain, which is when you would feel that your limbs are still there and you'd get cramps and like a lightning bolt hitting you under a toenail, stuff you couldn't get rid of. And I figured out a way around it without the use of medication. Like cold turkey, ditched my medication and started putting weight through the ends of my legs. And eventually it got rid of that physical pain. You know what I mean? It's all stuff that can be overcome one way or another. The mental pain is very similar. You know, a lot of people spend a massive amount of time training their body, but not very much time training their mind. You know, read the right books, consume the right content on social media, meditate, you know, spend time out. Stop watching garbage on telly. Spend that hour reading something that's going to strengthen your mind, you know, and help you to grow. This is something that as I've got older, I've understood a bit better. But failure, it's not failure if you learn from it, right? So again, I'll give you an example from the Invictus Games. I went there the first year and all I wanted to do was win gold medals. And I came back with 2 silvers and 2 bronzes. And I thought I'd failed. So I applied again for the next year. And then I took the lessons from those failures and applied them in my training for the following year. Came back with 4 gold medals. It's temporary. You have to learn. If you just go, okay, I failed, I'm done, then you failed. But if you go, okay, I didn't quite achieve the objective that time. What did I do wrong? What can I change and adjust? How can I tweak it? Then I'm going to go at it again with those adjustments. And then 9 times out of 10, that's where the success happens.